Hello and welcome to the Friday, August 26th, 2022 edition of On Iowa Politics. This week on the podcast, student loans are forgiven, Deidre Dejeer proposes a boost in state funding for public education, and we check in on Caleb to see if he has dried out yet from last Saturday at the state fair. Hello everyone, I'm Aaron Murphy, the Des Moines Bureau Chief for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids, and I'm glad to be back. After last week's vacation, I can now say that I unconditionally love myself and I can fully give my heart to my colleagues at the Gazette and here on the On Iowa Politics podcast. And much like Aaron Rodgers before me, I also had a, quote, magical experience with the sensation of feeling 100 different hands on my body. Or that might have just been when I was riding the Metro in D.C. It's tough to say. With me today on the podcast, our Gazette Deputy Bureau Chief and outstanding fill-in podcast host, Tom Barton. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Aaron.
Lee Des Moines Bureau Chief Caleb McCullough is here. Good morning, Caleb.
Good morning, Aaron. Happy to report that I am dry. I'm realizing that the shoes I wore that day are still out on my balcony because I put them there to dry, but I'll get them someday.
So the shoes, we still don't know the status. They could be still a little damp. Yeah. Okay. And also here is Jared McNett of the Sioux City Journal. Good morning, Jared.
Aaron, you know, what's actually happening with all of the debt forgiveness is I'm taking it all on myself. I'm now the sin eater for America's student loans. So you're welcome, everyone.
That's very big of you, Jared. Thank you so much. We all appreciate that.
Yes.
And I should say, just real quick, if you're feeling a little lost right now by my little intro, it's a response to last week's intro while I was off. So if you missed that podcast, number one, you're probably very confused right now, and I apologize for that. But number two, you should definitely go back and listen to the podcast because the whole thing was great.
This is a serialized show. A lot of people don't know that. They just think, you know, it's a new show. I can just pop in and out. No, not the case.
No, we're going to start numbering episodes and everything and giving them names. Yeah, you can't just pop in when you want, folks. You got to listen to us every week.
Also, ayahuasca, difficult word to pronounce.
I was impressed and actually revealed to me in that moment that I had never heard it said out loud. Like, I've read it, obviously, a number of times. But as I was listening to the podcast, I realized, like, oh, that's what that word is. That's what it sounds like. There you go. Not only did you fill in as a host, Tom, you taught me something. I feel like I learned something on last week's podcast, so thank you. All right. First up this week, let's put a pin on our coverage of the Iowa State Fair. And when we say our coverage, I really mean Caleb's coverage because he really stepped up for us with yours truly kind of taking some time off over the past month. And how was Caleb rewarded for shouldering the burden of his first state fair on the Iowa politics beat? He had to suffer through a torrential downpour in the middle of covering a candidate. But that's the Iowa State Fair, right? It's either 99 degrees and humid under cloudless skies, or it's raining. There seems to be no middle ground for state fair weather. So given that he had to suffer through all that, we're at least going to give him a few minutes here on the podcast to talk about it. So Caleb, check me if I'm wrong. The big storm rolled in while former Vice President Mike Pence was making his way across the fairgrounds, right? So give us the whole soaking story.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you know, I keep hearing about the state fair being hot, but it rained 3 of the 6 days that I was there. and I only remembered to bring an umbrella on the last day. So that was...
But was that at least the day of the downpour?
No.
Oh, no.
Yep. But yeah, so Mike Pence showed up last Friday, with Chuck Grassley, and he was thronged by local and national media, and they did a quick media scrum, where it was clear skies. And then right at the end of that, it started pouring, but you know, they took it in stride. They did a quick tour of the, of a lot of the fairgrounds. They were joined by other Republicans, Randy Feenstra, Zach Nunn, Marionette Miller Meeks. And Pence had also just come off a visit to New Hampshire, which is kind of a pretty blaring alarm that he's considering a presidential run. But in common fashion, he did not give us any hints last week about what that might look like. So like most of the national Republicans we've been seeing, you know, he said he was just there to support Chuck Grassley, and he brushed off any questions about his presidential ambitions. But he did repeat some comments he made in New Hampshire, you know, saying that Republicans shouldn't be criticizing rank and file members of the FBI or call to defund the FBI. kind of in response to the search of Mar-a-Lago. And he also said that he would consider speaking before the January 6th committee if he was called, but he didn't, you know, give much otherwise. There was one member of, I didn't catch if it was ABC or NBC, that, you know, followed him around the entire time asking over and over, are you going to testify before the committee? He didn't give up any more details other than, you know, I'll consider it. And I have to consider my unique role as vice president. So, and then Tom, we also speculated last week on whether it would be, you know, a warm welcome for Pence or if, his kind of opposition to Trump would create a hostile crowd. But I would say that he was very well received. You know, every time he walked by the some like beer tents or big areas, he got some cheers. There were some boos sprinkled in there, but it was mostly cheers. And, you know, you can't tell if that's coming from Democrats or from Republicans who are upset with him for certifying a legitimate election. But, you know, that's kind of the whole story. It was a pretty standard media event. But yeah, the big 2024 moment at this year's State Fair.
And you mentioned the one reporter's question, and then that makes me think to ask you, Caleb. So we'll see how much you've been indoctrinated now into being an Iowa politics reporter. How annoyed were/are you now by national media? Has that spiked? Because that's the measure. You know you're an Iowa reporter when you're complaining about the national reporters.
Right. It is, you know, it is a little harder to get questions in when there's that big a crowd. But it was also good to see, you know, good to be nice to be alongside them. You know, I'm sure that was not the first time, but it was an early time. So, you know, maybe with more of those, I might get a little more jaded, but yeah.
You'll get there. Trust me. And I, in all seriousness, there are some that I absolutely adore. Von Hilliard, who's been here a bunch of times, a fantastic reporter. Love seeing him every time he's out. Trip Gabriel from the Times, I think lived in Iowa practically for a year or two there. There's some good ones too.
If you want to get a question in during the scrum, what you need to do is just yell, "Oh my God," and point in a different direction from whatever it is that's going on. And then, you know, just, you know, get your question in.
When everybody turns.
Yeah, the national media people are very easily distracted. People don't know that, but they distract easily.
They're like the dog from Up. You just yell squirrel. Yes. And they... oh, fantastic. I'm staving that for next year in the caucus cycle. I'm putting that,
Caleb,
one in my pocket.
I was actually wondering, did Pence do anything in the way of talking about Trump at all? Like, did Trump's name even get mentioned while he was talking?
You know, when he was talking about the FBI comments, he did, he said, you know, this is an unprecedented search of a former president. I don't think he said Donald Trump, but he said, that's what he said. And then, you know, so that was a brief mention. And, you know, he didn't, you know, he's not celebrating that search by any means. You know, he's still saying, you know, we need to, or we can hold Merrick Garland accountable. Not necessarily saying for what, but, you know, that's kind of how he's taken this.
Yeah, interesting. And he didn't do any like big remarks, right? Like he didn't deliver a big stump speech anywhere or anything like that. He just kind of made his way through and glad handed and that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. So yeah. He had some opening comments before taking questions from reporters, but it wasn't for, you know, a general crowd. It was for the reporters. Yeah. And it was just, you know, I'm here to support my good friend, Chuck Grassley. And, you know, Iowa needs six more years of Chuck Grassley.
Yeah. Gotcha. All right. So on the bright side of this, and with the benefit of some passage of time now, we can say that it didn't take long for Caleb to get his first Truly Gate State Fair candidate coverage story, which again, we all have. Mine is having covered the absolute bonkers Saturday of the 2015 State Fair when Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and Bernie Sanders all came to the fair on the same day. That was just absolute insanity. Folks who follow this stuff closely may remember that was the day that Trump literally swooped in via helicopter. And then, as I understood it, Rod Boshart covered the story for us, but let kids who had come to see it get a quick helicopter ride. Just amazing stuff, an amazing day to be on the beach.
Was that when he said he was that when he said he was Batman? Because there's one time when he was like flying people around on a helicopter and a kid said something and then he like said he was Batman, or like I have a faint memory of Batman being involved with a helicopter ride with Trump at some point.
I honestly don't remember. Let's see. I'm going to the Google machine and I'm finding the story. Yes. Yep.
Okay.
That was it. Yep.
Good.
I'd forgotten about that. Fantastic. So you do this in that the state fair in general, the Des Moines Register's political soapbox always obviously brings candidates out, and eventually we all kind of have our story about covering candidates at the state fair. I don't know if you guys do, Tom and Jared, you're not right here in the Des Moines necessarily in the heat of it, but so maybe you don't, but do either of you have a classic state fair moment or memory?
Well, it isn't super specific, but like I just genuinely delighted in my first year going there. For me, it was 2019 because that was the first year after I moved up here. And, you know, there were like 10,000 different like Democratic candidates running around and debasing themselves by being forced to eat foods that should never be fried. And, you know, it was hot, but it wasn't like super miserable. And Slipknot was there, which is cool. And I got to try some of the award winners from like the previous years. And then, you know, I was also just there with like friends and family and my girlfriend. And we've now kind of chosen that date as like our anniversary date. So just, you know, a nice bunch of good vibes from the first time I was there.
There you go. Nice. How about you, Tom?
My memory is crap.
Well, you've been Eastern Iowa based here, so I mean,
I was in Des Moines for a couple of years with the Register. I mean, I wasn't covering politics, but mm-hmm. there was, you know, one summer where I was an intern and we were, you know, at the state fair for an entire week. Again, we weren't covering the candidates. We were doing more of the feature stories, the
right
sights, sounds, smells, foods, all that. But I vaguely remember running into Chet Colver and it being incredibly hot and him just sweating profusely.
Yeah, I could see that. Oh, yeah. Man. That's Jared, your story reminds me. I was also there the day after, or maybe even the day of, and the reaction was already coming in. Actually, now that I say it out loud, I think it was day of the now infamous Delaney photo of him coming down the slide.
Oh, and, yes.
And I was actually around his team as that was starting to go viral. And I remember the campaign's comms guy just kind of being like, you know, well, it is what it is now. There's nothing. There's no putting that genie back in the bottle.
Just having absolutely no fun whatsoever.
That is like not even just for like you know politics, but that just is an iconic moment for the state fair in general. Like that, an all time moment.
Man. Oh man, just amazing. Yep, fantastic. There's so many. I think it's actually a thing that campaigns talk about now. Like, you know, be careful about how you're photographed. Be aware of how you're being photographed at the state fair. There's a classic one from even further back of Rick Perry eating a corn dog that I won't elaborate on why that was made fun of because this is a family podcast. But it's to the point where, you know, campaigns are literally like, I think talk to their candidates about, hey, just be aware of what you're doing at all times and don't eat certain things. Don't go on certain rides.
There was one candidate who I will forever respect for not caring about that. And that was John Kasich in 2016. That man just wolfed down food left and right and never cared
so much.
He never cared how he looked. And I respect that. Like, like he would just be tearing into pizza, wings, didn't matter.
Oh, he ate it all. Oh yep. My God. He was amazing. That's right. Oh my gosh.
I remember the photos of him and eating the wings and thinking like, oh God, this is going to be terrible for him.
Yep.
And that was just the wings. That's not even taking into account everything else he had eaten around that. Oh my gosh. What a fair. You don't get any of this at the Minnesota State Fair. What are they talking about there?
No.
They're thinking nope. There's a better.
Ooh, shots fired on that one this week.
All right. Moving on. Begrudgingly, because that was fun. For the rest of this podcast, we're headed back to school, everybody. So pick up your pencils and get ready to take notes. This week, Deidre DeGere, the Democratic candidate for governor, unveiled her public education policy. Among the top liners in that policy drop was a $300 million one-time infusion of general aid to schools to be drawn out of the state's $1.4 billion budget surplus, and annual 4% general funding increases. And those annual increases have hovered more around 2% over the past decade, if not a little bit less than 2%. DeGere also proposed restoring public workers' collective bargaining rights and increasing pay for teachers, administrators, and staff, although the policy paper doesn't say how she would accomplish that last piece. Guys, education policy obviously is without a doubt one of the largest fault lines in this gubernatorial campaign. You have the incumbent Governor Kim Reynolds, Republican, who professes her strong support for public schools, but also wants a significant expansion of state funding for private school tuition assistance, which public school advocates vehemently oppose. And then here we have DeGere, the Democratic challenger, calling for more state funding for public schools. Tom, we'll start with you on this one. Is DeGere's proposal about what you would have expected from the Democratic candidate? Did anything in there surprise you or stand out otherwise?
Yeah, nothing in the policy really surprised me or stood out to me. Covering her campaigns and listening to her talk on the topic of public education, you know, this policy is very much in line with what she's been saying for months. And, you know, the $300 million one-time infusion, you know, is... it mirrors what Democrats in the Iowa legislature were asking for last session. So there's some rhyme and reason to it. So there was a basis, a rational foundation argument for that and why they came up with that number. Same with the 4%, you know, arguing that previous funding increases for K-12 education approved by the legislature have fallen well short of inflation, and that historically, you know, that number has been around roughly 4%. Although obviously, you know, today's environment, that number much more higher. And again, she's been a strong advocate proponent for workers, for unions, for organized labor, and you know, has decried changes in state law in recent years that have eroded collective bargaining rights for teachers. So that's not all that surprising. You know, that's a kind of a fundamental campaign issue platform of the Democratic Party. So, I mean, all in all, you know, this education policy really closely aligns to kind of what she's been saying on the campaign trail, in her stump speeches for a while now.
Yeah. And Caleb, you covered DeGere this week as she visited a Des Moines area elementary school on the day she announced this policy. What did she have to say to you about this policy, or, you know, anything beyond what we learned from the paper itself?
Yeah, well, she actually said a lot of what Tom just noted here, you know, that $300 million was based on what legislators asked for earlier this year, and, you know, also said that the 4%, she didn't say this directly, but she said she wanted the, you know, to let the funding of schools be not dictated, but guided by what the educators and schools are asking for. So, you know, the Iowa State Education Association asked for a 4% minimum increase this year, and that's, you know, partly where that number comes from. So she said that like, $300 million would be used for one-time expenditures, as you mentioned, but she said schools have a need for it and they could start using it right away. And she just kind of just said that she wants to let educators and school officials kind of set their requests and wanted the state to kind of give them what they said they need.
Yeah. And that 4%, and I try to point this out as much as I can, as often I can in my reporting on this, and so I'll take the opportunity here on the podcast too, for this ongoing, every, you know, annual now education funding debate. If you want to understand that in the simplest terms possible, that's what it is. It's that 4%, it's that annual increase. This has become a thing because for years and years and years, for literal decades, since the mid-70s when the formula was formed, the annual increases in state general funding were roughly, well, the average over the long haul is about 5%, but usually around 4% and certainly no less. And since Republicans gained at least control of one of the levers in 2011, that number has fallen significantly. And like I said, the average over those past, what are we up to now, 11 years, is around 2%. So that's because you'll get mixed messages, and Democrats will say, well, we're not enough. Republicans say, well, we're still putting in new money every year, which is true, and it's still X billion dollars, which is true. So at the heart of this whole debate that you hear every year over and over is that annual increase. That's where the divide came, and why we get – and now folks are free to decide on their own whether that's a 4% increase is enough or too much or this or that. But that's where this became a wedge issue politically at the State House over the past decade.
Not to cynically turn this in – to like horse racy type stuff instead of just a
please do. What else are we here for if we don't do that? Yeah,
I was just wondering, you know, how these sort of like proposals can help not only like Deidre DeGeer but also Democrats like in the fall and the election. Like, who is this kind of stuff play well with and maybe sway?
Yeah, I think it's a fair question. And one of the things I'll say right off the top is we regularly find that education policy in general is not typically a huge driver of voting behavior. It almost always still comes down to, you know, those kitchen table type issues, which is why you always still hear people, candidates talking about the economy and taxes. Now, this year in Iowa, in this race, I could see this factoring in some way. It's just such a stark contrast between the two candidates on this. And obviously the governor's private school tuition assistance plan has been in the headlines for two straight years now. And she made it an issue in the Republican primaries, getting some members of her own party knocked out in favor of others who are willing to come along with her. So I would say normally we're probably talking about something that nobody's going to vote about anyway at the end of the day. But I could see that being different this year in this specific case in this race. Caleb or Tom, if you have anything to add to that.
I mean, I think potentially for Democrats, you know, where this could potentially help them is with Obama-Trump voters in rural areas. Because if you think about it, in most rural places, the school district is the largest employer. And particularly in some of those rural communities, again, like particularly along the Mississippi River, those rural communities where, you know, you used to have a strong, a strong contingent of Democrats and blue collar workers, working class background, communities that, you know, for decades reliably voted for Democrats, you know, backed Obama, but then swung the other way and voted for Trump. This potentially could be a swayable issue for them. You know, when you talk about, you know, shifting tax dollars, shifting public funding from, again, one of many of these communities is the largest employer, to potentially send students out of the district, or shift that funding to allow students in other districts to go to private schools. You know, yeah, that could be an issue that really can resonate with them and can move them. And particularly, and especially, you know, if you're making the case that we need to be paying teachers more, that we should be restoring collective bargaining rights for them. You know, a lot of voters in that district, you know, probably have somebody in their family, you know, if not, you know, their wife or whatever. I mean, they probably have a family member who's employed by the district and would directly benefit from that.
And not only are those schools in those smaller communities the biggest employer, but it's essentially a lot of times that community's identity almost, right, is built around the school. And if that school goes away, if something to happen happens where that school closes, or we went through a phase of consolidation in past years in Iowa and school districts kind of merging to stay afloat, and how upsetting that was to some people in communities. So there's that aspect of it too, where a community's identity is really kind of connected to its school. The threat of that going away could be something that motivates voters as well. That's a great point, Tom.
Absolutely. And Eric Van Lanker, DeGere's running mate, really seized on that. When I spoke to him, a couple of weeks ago, he was at a Linn County Democrats meeting, and he had been traveling to these rural communities, and that's exactly what he said, and said what he was hearing from voters he was talking to, you know, voters who were wearing, t-shirts, sweatshirts with the high school mascot on it. It's that community pride.
Yep. You do have to wonder if, kind of a detailed policy like this, if that's going to make any difference versus kind of just saying on the campaign trail and, reading in a news story, Dieter DeGier wants to increase funding for education, right? I mean, I don't know how many people would not be swayed by that, but then would kind of read the line item of that policy and think, hey, maybe there might be a group, who's like, well, doesn't really think much about it if it's kind of just a word, but might read into a little more detail. But yeah, I don't know if the kind of line by line policy is too swaying.
Yeah, I think part of it is the messaging too. To hear or read a headline that says Dieter DeGier wants to increase education funding, I think for a certain segment of voters, particularly Republican conservative voters, they might read that and be like, oh, okay, great. Does that mean that she wants to increase our taxes, or how is she gonna pay for that? Versus saying that I want to save jobs for the largest employer in a lot of rural counties and in rural districts. I think it's an issue of framing, and depending on how Democrats and the DeGier campaign frame it, if they frame it, more toward the latter, potentially they could be successful in making some inroads in some of these places where, Democrats have been losing support for the last couple of elections.
And to your point about messaging in places where they're having trouble maintaining population, I mean, we've talked about that in the past, how the smaller towns are losing people, and you could talk about that as an issue and say, hey, this is just going to be one more thing that drives people away from your small town. We'll follow that and see how that debate plays out. I'm sure we'll hear more about that in the coming weeks here leading up to November 8th. Finally, this week, we move on to the federal level, but stay in the education realm. President Joe Biden announced the federal government will forgive student loan debt of up to $10,000 for individuals who make $125,000 annually. And if I remember, it's another $10,000 for Pell Grant folks who have Pell Grants. The announcement addresses an issue that was very common on the 2020 campaign trail, especially for Democrats. We heard that constantly in the presidential primary, that the need to address student loan debt. Now the move also has its critics, including Republicans, obviously, but not exclusively Republicans. There are some debates that are just so silly that we're not even going to mention them here. I'll just say that they fall under the old "when I was a kid, I walked uphill both ways to school" category. But there are some actual legitimate concerns, including from experts, about whether this is the right way to address the broader issue that is the ever-ballooning cost of college. Now, all that said, clearly this is going to be a good thing in the short term for a lot of college graduates saddled with debt. That's just a fact, regardless of where you stand on the policy itself. Now, as I sometimes say around here, this is a political podcast, so let's ask the political question. Jared, is this move by the Biden administration a good thing or a bad thing politically for Democrats this November? Or I suppose I should add option C, which would be it won't really matter either way.
Well, I mean, if you just monitor responses from like rank and file Democrats, which I grant isn't the most rigorous way of doing things, it's a good thing politically for Biden and for the party. A, because people like when the government gives them stuff. The COVID checks were a great example of that in recent years. you know, and just in my own life with like the COVID checks, even people who skew conservative were plenty happy about that money coming in, even under Biden, and they didn't have much to grouse about with Biden on that matter. And then also, you know, passing this kind of stuff signals to your base that you're working for them, and heading into an election, that's particularly important because there are plenty of people who aren't going to want to go to vote for you in an off-year election if they don't have any real sense that you're doing anything for them at all. Then what's the motivation?
Real quick. Sorry, Jared, I don't mean to interrupt, but I want to nail down on that a little further because, and it's interesting because up until, man, maybe about a month or so ago, you heard a lot about that on the Democrat side, right? Like, especially from younger voters and frustration. Like, why did we bother doing all that work to get this guy elected? He's done nothing that we asked him to do. And now in the last, you know, month or so, we've seen some big things like this, like the Inflation Reduction Act that included a ton of climate policy in it. So it seems like it took a while, but the administration finally got to that checklist, it seems like.
No, totally. That's a big animating thing. And then the other thing that's animating, maybe not in terms of elections, but, you know, whether we like it or not, a big factor in politics now is people want to see members of the other party get owned. And there's plenty of delight among Democrats that Republicans are apoplectic about this. You know, GOP members of like the Iowa delegation called it a handout and wealth redistribution. And, you know, that's let Democratic folks in the state just quote tweet all of those tweets with screenshots of forgiven PPP loans. And so they get to feel good about that. And
farm subsidies. And
yeah, exactly. That's a part too. That doesn't matter when we go to the polls probably, but you know, that's a modern day phenomenon in politics in America. So it matters to some extent.
Well, and speaking of that, that's a perfect segue because, Tom, I wanted to ask you, we know obviously that Republicans were against this. So we don't need to bother going down that laundry list. But how did Iowa's Democratic candidates for Congress react to the announcement? Because when you look at the broad scope, like Jared mentioned, the rank and file largely were supportive of it. But there were some more muted or even non-reactions. What did Iowa's Democrats have to say about it?
Yeah, so there were some criticisms among Democrats running in the general election this fall. So Iowa Democratic State Senator Liz Mathis, who is running to challenge Iowa Republican Representative Ashley Hinton, issued a statement saying that she works in the state Senate to bring down the cost of college and increase access to skills training for good paying jobs that we need to fill here in Iowa, but said that we need a policy at the federal level that does the same, and feels that the Biden administration student loan forgiveness plan, falls short of addressing the root problems of college affordability. Iowa Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Mike Franken, who's running to challenge Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, kind of echoed Mathis in a post on Twitter, saying that the administration's college debt forgiveness plan does not fix the problems associated with the cost of higher education and that a far more comprehensive approach is needed.
Those are similar to what I've heard elsewhere too. So that was interesting. Caleb, you didn't intentionally recuse yourself from this discussion as the most recent college grad in the room, but because of that, I wanted to give you the last opportunity. Say what you can as objectively as possible on this, being a very recent college graduate. What do you think about this move?
Well, I will say, since I didn't file any tax returns until last year, I never got any stimulus checks, so I could be pretty objective about that. But I have to say, I'm getting a little bit of a increase in my net worth here after this. But you know, as a political matter, you know, who knows? I think it can help. You know, as Jared said, with those Democrats who are Democrat leaning younger voters who may not be excited to come out in a midterm, but you know, see this as something that's helping them. But I do think also there's some liability for some Democrats in more Republican-leaning districts, like the ones Tom mentioned, because I think, you know, kind of the older independent voter who might, you know, see certain benefits of a Democratic Congress and want to lean that way, but, you know, thinks that this is a giveaway or thinks that it's, you know, transferring the payments onto hardworking Americans, you know, so it's a difficult needle to thread, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see it to what degree it plays out. I think that's it, folks. We've reached the end of another On Iowa Politics podcast. If you enjoyed it, please tell your friends and subscribe to us on any number of streaming audio services, just subscribe, smash that button. If you have any suggestions for topics to discuss, or you just want to reach out, you can send an email to podcasts@thegazette.com. And now that you've listened to the On Iowa Politics podcast, make sure you're also subscribed to the On Iowa Politics newsletter, where every morning in your inbox, you'll get all the latest politics and government coverage from our team and my terrible ability to put graphic elements into a newsletter. You can subscribe to that On Iowa Politics newsletter on thegazette.com. Lastly, don't forget that the work of everyone you heard here today can be found on the pages and websites of the Quad City Times, Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, Sioux City Journal, Mason City Globe Gazette, Muscatine Journal, Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil, and the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Dead Larry will play us out this week. If you know an Iowa band or musician who should be featured on the show, please send us a sound file. For Tom, Caleb, Jared, and our producer Steven, I'm Aaron Murphy. Thanks for listening.
Get a daily update from the Gazette with our daily news podcast. Add it to your podcast player or your Alexa-friendly device to get a bite-sized local news update each day. Check it out at thegazette.com/podcasts.